Good morning. Well, Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and Cyber Monday have come and gone. Let's call today Anticipation Sunday. Hanukkah begins in a mere 10 days. The winter solstice occurs the next day. Santa Claus arrives in 13 or 14 days. Kwanzaa begins the following day. And the year 2012 of the Common Era begins in 21 days. And the Super Bowl is only 56 days away. You may be excited about some or even all of these momentous events, or you might be one of a fairly large share of the population who face this season's celebrations and hoopla with dread and foreboding. Whichever camp you are in, we promised to do our best to make you feel welcome here. I direct your attention to the order of service. It is chock-a-block of announcements of coming events. More information about fellowship activities is available in our newsletter, which copies of which are available in the narthex, as well as online at www.uufm.net. And I have one additional announcement to read. 1 week from today, at 4 o'clock, Laverne Baker and Mary Cottle Kidd do the Christmas story in Negro Spirituals, and it is free. Oh, it is at the First United Methodist Church, 612 Points Avenue. Now light the chalice. This chalice is the symbol of our free and generous faith. May its light reach into dark places to offer hope to the hopeless, to comfort the suffering, to bring reason where there is ignorance, to show understanding where there is hatred, and to shine like a beacon showing us the way home. Our opening hymn is number 235, Deck the Hall with Boughs of Holly. The hall is singular, because even very large homes in 19th century England had just one hall to deck or orate. Slavomir, please stand as you're able.
Thank you.
Now, if there are any children here, I haven't heard many of them, but there must be some here. If they would come forward, Corey will give them a seasonal greeting of some sort. You got the microphone? There you go.
Hello. Yes. Hi. Is it working? Can you hear me? It's working. Okay. I thought we would spend some time today getting some energy out, getting a little physical. So let's take a place on the stage. You're going to need a little bit of space. Yeah. It's good in the winter to get the blood pumping, get it flowing. Okay, so yeah, get a good spot. And let's start with some jumping jacks. Give me 10. Yeah. Great. Awesome. And now if you could just run in place. 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 Okay, drop and give me 10 push-ups. Push it up. Push it up. Push it up. Come on. Come on, guys. Give it, yes, go, go, go. Wow. This is impressive. Okay, great. Okay, and then we're going to do ups and downs. You're going to jump up, touch your toes. Jump up, touch your toes. Yeah, they're called jump ups. Okay. Woo. Wow. Okay. Are you guys feeling a little thirsty after that? Okay, I've got some water for you here. Okay. Ah, it's good. It's refreshing. This is so refreshing. Who would like some? Okay, great. Just ignore the leaves at the top. It's fine. It's totally clean. Mmm. Who's thirsty?
What is it?
Yeah, you guys worked hard. Yum.
What is it?
It's water. Just some water. Yeah, it's great. It's just a little bit of water. It's just water. Yeah. It's just a little dirty. Is that okay?
That's good.
I just a little dirty.
I'm so glad that I just have water.
You're just so glad that you have water at all. Not feeling it. Not feeling into it. No. Okay. All right. Anybody else want to try some dirty water? No. Oh, you got a leaf. Lucky you. Okay. Great. Doesn't taste good. Doesn't taste good. So, is this what the water looks like at your house?
No.
What? I just got this water. No, it's clear.
Much clearer than this.
And it doesn't have leaves in it? Really? Okay, I'll take that back. This is a fellowship leaf, Nick. Okay, fellowship leaf. Okay. This was a bit of a setup, right? Because this water is yucky. It's a water. It's a little dirty water, but it's water. Doesn't seem dirty. Oh, good. I'm so glad. So you know we've been talking about the guest at your table box, and you guys have been asking adults to help participate in the guest at your table program. So one of the individuals on that box, his name is Christus Mondabi. I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, I'm sure. But he is working in Kenya to clean up their water, because this is kind of what their water can look like. This is what they have to drink, and then they have to try to clean it so they can drink it. Yeah. We're super lucky. We turn on the faucet and our water is clean and it even has fluoride in it and it's been made so nice for us to drink. You can't
taste the grossness.
You can taste the grossness. Yeah. Yeah, it's gross, dude. Okay. Ew. So we're super lucky, but the reason why we're collecting money this month as part of our holiday season is to help this awesome guy in Kenya help to save the rainforest there, and it's part of that process to clean up their water. After having this dirty water, do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think clean water is a good thing. Yeah. Okay, we can go and have some clean water later. Okay, thank you guys.
Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the Spirit of God surround us. You will notice that Rod France has been reincarnated into a new person to make the plea for Helping Hands Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, please.
You're all going to get this, I'll tell you.
I know there's a limit on how long it can take. But since I'm going to mutter and mumble a bit, I'll really try. But Michael's going to be standing here to pull me off. So, okay. MESI, Manhattan Emergency Shelter, is, I am sure, an agency which you are somewhat aware of. It's on the edge of Yuma Street and houses people who are homeless. When they come to the shelter, they are not just given shelter. They are given training to get jobs, terribly important thing, and are helped to find jobs, helped to find somewhere to move into. They are not encouraged to just come to the shelter and stay there forever and ever. So there's a very positive attitude. The shelter has a very, very small budget, something like $100 a year. So they rely on people giving them food. Through the kitchen, We do take food over there, and very often any food that's left over from here we take there. This is an agency that truly is needed in this community, and I know we have supported it for years. So what I'm asking for today is some money from all of you when the basket goes round to buy some gifts for the people who will be in the shelter this Christmas. I was down at the shelter the other day, and they have a lot of people who have not yet been, quote, adopted. I took mostly children because the children from our RA group are going to help us. But I looked at some of the things they were asking for. They were not extravagant things. The people who are there, though poor and homeless, are not asking for the world. They are asking for things like a potty chair, things that are going to be important to them as they move on. So please be as generous as possible during this time. It's a wonderful agency, and the people deserve all the help that we can give them. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I remind everybody during that unless your check is specifically earmarked for the fellowship, it will go to this good cause. Slavomir? The formal part of the program is titled, "Tis the Season to Be." The inspiration for the title came to me last Sunday during the program presented by several members on the towel. Whatever follows the bee is up to you.
My name is Deirdre Greeley, and I am a leader of the pagan group here at the UUFM. So every Christmas, as a Wiccan or a pagan, I kind of smile when I see the Christmas traditions that everybody, even worldwide, uses. So I kind of thought that maybe we could talk a little bit about what we're actually celebrating and where some of those traditions come from, because to me, they're very meaningful, and I really get a kick out of the fact that the Christians do these things and maybe don't know where they're coming from. So let's set the record straight. Christmas is celebrated worldwide on December 25th and is the Christmas celebration of the birth of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. But a closer inspection of those biblical accounts of Jesus' birth reveals that he was not born in December. In the New Testament book of Luke, Luke tells us that Jesus' parents, Mary and Joseph, were on their way to Nazareth to take part in the census. And later in the book, it's written that the nativity star heralding Christ's birth was sighted by shepherds tending their flocks by night. So why would shepherds be tending their flocks at the end of December? And history tells us that the censuses in Nazareth and other small towns usually began in the spring. So why do the Christians celebrate the birth of Jesus in the wintertime? And there's one reason. It was a marketing strategy. Let's back up for a moment and look at the world as it was at the time of Jesus' birth and for the first few hundred years afterwards. Most of the Middle East was under Roman rule, and the Romans were polytheistic pagans. They venerated many gods. There were very specific and widespread celebrations honoring many of their deities, and the most celebrated of these celebrations was Saturnalia, and it's in honor of the god Saturn. The god Saturn is said to have established the Golden Age, a time of perfect peace and harmony, which lasted as long as he reigned. And in memory of that golden age, the Feast of Saturnalia was held every year at the winter solstice. During this time, no war could be declared. Slaves and masters switched roles and ate at the same table. All executions were postponed, and it was a season for giving gifts. This was a time of total abandon and merrymaking. It refreshed the idea of equality, a time when all men were on the same level. It lasted from December 17th through the 24th of December. The next day, December 25th, they celebrated the birthday of Mithras. Mithras is better known to most as Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, S-U-N. Which ties him directly to the winter solstice on December 21st. The winter solstice is the longest night of the year and the shortest day. From the solstice on, the days begin getting increasingly longer and the nights shorter. This day is considered a holy day and thus was celebrated by early civilizations throughout the world as the birth of the sun, S-U-N. But wait a minute. The birth of the sun. Pretty convenient, and Pope Julius I thought so. He reigned from 337 to 352 Common Era, and he decided to officially decree that Jesus' birthday was December 25th. He had hopes that this new holiday would take hold under the guise of the old holidays, thus guaranteeing its success. And it did. Or did it? Because maybe the Christians still don't understand what they're celebrating. So you might be saying, well, that's the 25th, but what about other things like Santa Claus or gifts and stockings or Yule logs? Well, we have the early Germanic and Norse pagans to thank for these things. From December 20th through December 31st, was the Norse holiday called Yule, and they spelled it J-U-L, and later we Americanized it or Anglicized it, to the Yule the way we spell it today. It was a 12-day festival, like the 12 days of Christmas, celebrating the great ride or the wild hunt. And their god, Odin or Woden, rode across the sky on his eight-legged horse, Sleipnir. Woden is depicted at this time as an old man with a flowing white beard. Germanic and Norse children would leave their boots out by the hearth filled with hay and sugar for Sleipnir's journey. And in return, Woden would leave them a gift for their kindness. Over the years, eight-legged Sleipnir became eight reindeer, and Woden became Sinterklaas. He was a saint who wore a red cape and rode through the sky on a white horse. And of course, from there on, we've kept changing Santa Claus into the gentleman that we see here. And Clement Moore, I think, had a lot to do with that, with the Night Before Christmas that he wrote. And during those 12 days of Yule, fathers and sons would bring home huge logs to burn on the hearth in the hopes that these Yule logs would burn all 12 nights. And children at this time would bring in evergreen boughs and hang fruits and put candles on them to honor Woden. And in the ancient Celtic lore, the winter solstice is the last day of the reign of the Holly King. He's also an old man with a white beard who wears a wreath of holly on his head, and he's a friend to winter animals, especially the horned deer. On the winter solstice, he's defeated by the Oak King, who will rule over the next half of the year when the sun is waxing. So what about mistletoe? Again, we have the Norse people to thank for that. After the sun god Balder was killed by wicked Loki's mistletoe dart, the plant was feared and hated by all as the wicked instrument of death and betrayal. And this story probably surely stems from the fact that mistletoe berries are very poisonous. But Baldur's mother, the goddess Freya, redeemed it in honor of her son, decreeing that mistletoe should become a symbol of peace and reconciliation. From that time on, enemies who met under a clump of mistletoe would lay down their arms and declare a truce. That's why it's hung in the doorway to this very day, and a kiss of peace and loving kindness is bestowed on all who enter. One more thing the Norse gave us is their greeting, Vasheil, meaning good health. The early Anglo-Saxons took that even further, and we kind of anglicized that to wassail today. We have wassail bowls. I know people make kettles of wassail, and it's traditionally apple cider or hard apple cider, apple ale. The early Anglo-Saxons would take that bowl of apple cider or ale to their orchards. And during the winter solstice, they would sing to their trees in order to ensure the ongoing fertility and reproduction. This was called wassailing the trees. And there's a rhyme from old Anglo-Saxon times that is, wassail the trees that they may bear you a plum and many a pear, for more or less fruits they will bring as you do give them wassailing. So as you can see, over time, as people began to travel and trade routes began to flourish, many of these pagan stories blended into the icons that we now associate with Christmas. So this year, when you deck your halls, go wassailing or hang a stocking, sneak a kiss under the mistletoe, leave food out for Santa's reindeer, bake a Yule log cake, or decorate an evergreen, I ask you to remember for just a moment the pagans who long ago, in times of darkest cold, gathered together with fire and friends to celebrate the return of the sun, and in doing so, gave us what we know today as Christmas. Thank you.
morning. This time of year, I always think of the wish, peace on earth, goodwill to all. And I was asked to say a few things on the subject of my choosing. So peace on earth, goodwill to all, seemed like a good one. How do we relate to each other? Interdependence. We hear a lot about interdependence in the Buddhist tradition. And in the yoga tradition and the Buddhist tradition, we try to cultivate the four attitudes towards all being and beings. And those attitudes are kindness, compassion, joy, and freedom. So I want to read a few quotes here, and they all relate to interdependence and compassion, starting with Herman Melville. We cannot live for ourselves alone. Our lives are connected by 1,000 invisible threads, and along these sympathetic fibers, our actions run as causes and return to us as results. D.H. Lawrence. Oh, what a catastrophe, that a maiming of love when it was made personal, merely personal. This is what is the matter with us. We are bleeding at the roots because we are cut off from the earth and sun and stars. Love has become a grinning mockery because, poor blossom, we picked it from its stem on the tree of life and expected it to keep on blooming in our civilized vase on the table. From Albert Einstein, a human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as separate from the rest, a kind of optical illusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to the affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Charles Darwin. As man advances in civilization and small tribes are united into larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all the members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. This point being once reached, there is only an artificial barrier to prevent his sympathies extending to the men of all nations and races. That was Charles Darwin. Now we'll go to Chief Seattle. What befalls the earth befalls all the sons of the earth. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected, like the blood that unites us all. Man does not weave this web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. And also from Chief Seattle, what is man without the beasts? For whatever happens to the beasts soon happens to man. All things are connected. And from Albert Schweitzer, until mankind can extend the circle of his compassion to include all living things, he will never himself know peace. Martin Luther King, before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half the world. This is the way our universe is structured. This is its interrelated quality. We aren't going to have peace on earth until we recognize the basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality. And then from the Bible, from Matthew 25:40. The king will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you did for me. Peace.
Hi. I'm here from the first half of the 20th century. In the beginning was the Word. By 1944, I was a pretty good reader. In our country school, we read Dick and Jane books, but when I came home, we'd spread out the Indianapolis Star and read Major Hoople and other comics aloud to Mom. Major Hoople was a fat, lazy ne'er-do-well who chomped on day-old cigars and left home early in the day to escape the purview of Martha, his even fatter wife, and go down to the Owls Club to smoke, play cards, and blather. Late at night, he'd come home, and Martha would be waiting for him, rolling pin in hand, ready to bop him one. "Egad, Martha," he'd say. "Harumph. I was detained at the club for an important meeting of the officers." Mom was a working-class gal from the wrong side of the Indianapolis tracks, John Dillinger's girlfriend and Hoagy Carmichael, the guy who wrote Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, were in her circle of friends, but she was an A student. In 1932, she'd been out of high school several years, working at Swing Tag, when she met my father, a resident in ophthalmology and otorhinolaryngology at the University of Indiana Hospital. They met at one of those prohibition basement parties where the young doctors were invited not for their good looks so much as for their ability to cage pure alcohol from the hospital to make bathtub gin. So they met there, and some ancillary chemistry took place. Next day, he phoned her to tell her he had seen brown eyes in his coffee that morning. And a few months later, they were married in front of a wicket by a clerk in the courthouse downtown. In 1942, Dad went overseas to North Africa. Mom taught me to read. She didn't have a degree or anything, certainly not in reading science or epistemology or anything like that. She just did it in her own way. In one of the comic strips, I ran across the word enterprise. "What's that mean?" I asked Mom. "Well," she said, taking a long drag on her Chesterfield cigarette, "that's where you enter something and you get a prize." Made sense to me. So that Christmas 1944, I was eagerly awaiting gifts, but mindful of the ominous lines from Santa Claus Is Coming to Town, a song I'd heard on the radio, I guess, because there wasn't anywhere else to hear it. Those lines, to wit, "You'd better be good for goodness sake, you better watch out, you better not pout, I'm telling you why, SC is coming to town." I believed in Santa. I lay awake nights contemplating him. I'd never seen him. They not only didn't have Santa Clauses in stores then, where we lived in the old holler, they didn't even have stores. But I was a true believer, and like all true believers, the more improbable the belief, the firmer mine became. At dawn on Christmas morning, my brother and I tumbled out of bed to see what Santa had left for us. My brother, 4 years older, might by then have been a skeptic. Yet there was proof positive, propped against the wall by the glittering tree, almost covered by the stacks of wrapped packages I'd been fingering for days, a glorious surprise, a blackboard. A blackboard. I could not have imagined such a gift. A full choir of singing angels could not have stunned me more. And on this real slate blackboard was written these words, "Merry Christmas to Charlie from Santa Claus." Egad, harumph, I was thunderstruck. I really, really was. Not only had this mythical guy somehow gotten down our smoky, smelly chimney carrying this blackboard, probably 2 feet high and 3 feet wide, but he had taken the time to write that line specifically to me. A few years later, my father came home from the war, and by then, living here in Manhattan, I was a student at Eugene Field School, and we had our monthly visit from our science teacher. Another pupil and I had a fierce discussion going. Santa Claus, my friend maintained, did not exist. When the teacher sat down at his desk, my hand went up. "Say it isn't so." I don't remember the particular verbal gymnastics the poor man went through. He squirmed and lamely explained and explained. And there it was in a handful of chalk dust. No Santa. No doubt he didn't sleep well that night. I didn't either. It was the end of something for me. I wasn't just devastated. My world was obliterated. I staggered under the weight of this new and uncomfortable knowledge that was a kind of a malign force. In place of the Santa who had given me the reality of words was some sad, sissified construct of metaphor and myth, all murk and mirrors. I seethed with the betrayal. In one swoop, I had gone from someone who said yes to someone who said no, and I didn't like it one bit. Thank you.
I was very fortunate many years ago that my family, my parents, decided that what they needed to give us for Christmas were their memories. And so my father, who loved to write, went back and tried to remember everything about his little childhood. And this works out perfectly, I think, for welcoming our winter. The first thing you need to know, however, is you need to know a vocabulary word. That is ankle skating. I will show you as much as I can.
Normal? Ankle skating.
That's my preferred method. Okay. Skating on your ankles. Every year, again, these are the words of my father, probably taking place in the late 30s. So thank you, Charlie, for the intro. Every year in my hometown, somewhere around the beginning of November, the winter turns from Indian summer to fall and then a quick turn to winter. The snow just seems to pile up almost overnight. Then the city workers begin to prepare our city commons for ice skating. The commons encompasses a full square block. The skating rink is a circle within that area. The fire department floods the skating area on the first day that the temperature hits the freezing level. This, of course, is not a day, this is not a problem in Montana. This is the average temperature from November to March of each year. We would go to the skating rink on a daily basis and check on the surface, hoping that the ice is ready for us. During this freezing period, a shelter is constructed that has benches for changing into your skates, a huge stove in the center that will be surrounded by all who will have stayed on the rink too long and are nearly frozen, and by those who want to get warm before going to the rink. Each year, we were able to celebrate the approaching Christmas season as a huge Christmas tree was placed dead center in the rink. Its average height was 50 feet. And it was decorated by lights from top to bottom, and strings were extended from the tree to 6 points to the rim of the rink. And a stereo played seasonal music so you could skate in rhythm. Now, that is a description of the recreation opportunity for all residents in my hometown. My first year of skating included a pair of ice skates that were designed to clamp on your street shoes, and they would come loose before you could make one lap around the rink. These would either release from not being tight enough or if the sole of your shoe would release, which was much more often the case. My first pair of shoe skates were owned by someone who had a size 7 foot. My size was 5 and a half. That was another reason for purchasing the local newspaper and having a good pair of wool socks. It didn't matter. I had shoe skates, and I was ready for the winter. I sharpened the blades, oiled the shoes, and carried them over my shoulder to the rink. Now inside the change house, I began putting on my skates. It was warm, and the smell of wood was burning, and apples cooking on top of the stove. Some were done, some were burning, and some had done been burnt. I started down the steps toward the ice. I planned to skate like Sonia Henney, the current Olympic skating champion. And why not me? I may someday be that good. Days before coming to the rink, I put on my skates and stood on them, proving to myself that I'd be able to skate. I reached the ice, my courage on hand, my desire at the peak, my ankles at right angles to the ice. I took 5 steps in the direction of the tree. I coasted fine, ankles erect, but then I needed more momentum. I stroked hard, and again my ankles bent to the will of the ice. My best friend Dick, who had always had the best equipment no matter what sport he was undertaking, he didn't have normal skates, he had racers. I tried to keep up with him, but my efforts were futile. I went to the side of the rink, sat on the 4-foot pile of snow that rimmed the rink, and watched those with steel ankles skate to music. Well, not to be deterred, I went onto the rink about 6 feet out and ankle-powered to the snow pile. I jumped in and I sank waist deep. Dick came over following the routine, and he jumped in. Sam followed. Fred Hunkel followed. We'd found a new game, and I was able to participate with my oversized skates. My ankles a little sore, but I could jump just as far as the rest. After 4 jumps into the snow, the chills began to set in, and all of us started to the change house, those who could skate and those of us that had to ankle hook their whole way. The change house was warm and time was growing late. We were to be home shortly, but the smell of the change house, the view of the lighted tree will remain as a beautiful memory. The thought of skating on my ankles, no thanks.
We're going to sing our closing hymn. The choir should be working the way up here. They'll lead us in 224, Let Christmas Come. After we sing the hymn, please be seated for some brief closing words. Then after the choir sings what has become our traditional closing to the holiday service, please join us for refreshments, conversation, and the opportunity to purchase unique, moderately priced, homemade holiday gifts for loved ones and friends.
Closing words by David S. Blanchard, All I Want for Christmas. Reverend Blanchard's wishes do not include a long list of things for himself and for us. Instead, he hopes for a deeper connection with life to help give expression to our love, a sense of clarity that illuminates what it is we are doing and why, and finally, not outward signs of generosity, but an internal sense of caring that guides us to give in any season.
Don't forget to leave your music, please.